From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. This morning we speak with sports physician Dr. Max Testa, who runs the Sports Performance Center at Intermountain Park City Hospital. He'll talk to us about how they scientifically help people find the most efficient and effective path to fitness and performance. Then author Meg Zucker, who has written Born Extraordinary, Empowering Children with Differences and Disabilities. You won't want to miss her story, her personal story. These guests, when we return, you're listening to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm David Windsor.
Now, there's plenty of science that can tell us if our efforts at fitness and sports performance are efficient, or maybe if we're working out too hard or doing too much to achieve the results we want. While we might think we know our bodies, the experts at the Sports Performance Center at Intermountain Park City Hospital can do very specific testing to inform us on our sports physiology. Dr. Max Testa is a sports physician and a longtime Park City resident, and he joins us now to discuss the intricacies and the science of fitness. Dr. Max Testa, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Good morning. Thank you.
Well, we always love to have you join us, Dr. Testa. And, you know, we see your smiling face around the halls of Park City Hospital and the LiveWell Center and on the trails here in Park City. But many people don't know your background. Can you take us back to when you were a young medical student in Italy and you drew the short straw and had to deal with Team 7-Eleven?
Oh, yeah. But, that goes back a long time. That was 1985. I was just fresh out of my fellowship in sport medicine. And the 7-Eleven team, that was the first U.S. team to come to Europe to compete in one of the big tours, like the Tour de France, Tour of Italy. They show up at the Tour of Italy, and they didn't have a doctor. So the organization connected them with my university to get the doctor to cover the 3 weeks race, and nobody want to go. Nobody else want to go. They were a little afraid about this team because they had a reputation to be dangerous riders. They were taking a risk in the third. So I was the youngest. So my chair looked and said, Dr. Testa, you go. And so I find myself in Verona, Italy, meeting, you know, some of those riders that became basically the first wave of Americans succeeding and doing very well in international cycling, like Andy Hampstead, that won the Tour of Italy 2-3 years later. Eric, now Dr. Eric Hayden, orthopedic surgeon here in Park City, and other ones like Davis Finney, Kiefel, Ron Kiefel. So some of these guys that went on for the next 10 years to become international, well-respected athletes.
Yes. Fast forward, you know, many decades, and you have been a sports physician for many different teams, especially cycling teams, and you have attended as a sports physician how many Tour de France and how many Giro d'Italia and like that?
Tour de France, I know for sure because I counted them 28, and I was trying to make it to 30, but with COVID, I kind of lost momentum. So, but you know, I think still it's kind of a record for a physician working with teams. And so that was a good, I would say, personal satisfaction. Tour of Italy, maybe 10 or 15. I did more Tour de France because most of the teams I was working for, they were focusing more on the Tour de France. I did maybe another 10, 15 Tour of Spain, maybe 20 World Championship. So with cycling, I've been traveling for 35 years. To all these races around the world.
That's incredible. What a long run. And I'm sure you've seen a lot of incredible things, especially with the Tour de France. I'm very invested in this topic. It's something I'm very passionate about and have been my entire life as an athlete. You talk about the physiology testing that gives the athlete the baseline. Walk us through the testings and what you're doing to get those baselines for those athletes.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. So this is something that I've been working on for like 40 years. That has been my thing, working with the athlete on the side of the performance. So like take an athlete, I would say analyze the athlete in terms of energy generating machine. You know, in every sport, availability of energy is one of the limiting factors, in some sport more than others. For example, in cycling, energy availability is definitely the limiting factor. They say the same could probably be said in sport like cross-country skiing or rowing. In sport like golf, for example, that shouldn't be the main factor. It's more like neuromuscular coordination and a psychological ability to focus and stay concentrated and control the stress during the critical moments. So let's say that in general, the work of a sport physiologist or a performance specialist is to analyze the athlete with respect of the sport that this athlete is practicing. So we have for each sport, we have a physiological, let's say energetic, and a neuromuscular or biomechanical model that we know that sport, that for each sport, and each sport is predictor of performance. So like we know in cycling and in running, especially long distance running, the strongest predictor of performance is the power over weight ratio at your lactate ratio. And in other sport, like in soccer, is not so much an energetical limitation, but is more like the ability to be technically precise and have a low cost of performing some movements, some tasks. So basically what we try to do at the Park City Hospital, like around the world, they're doing all the performance center, is to take every individual as an individual, so analyze this subject physiological characteristics, match to the sport they like to succeed in, and try to break down their performance and their physiology, and recommend what to do to intervene on all those factors that are currently limiting them. So like say you're a runner, you want to qualify for Boston, and you're a 50-year-old subject with no major medical issue. So what we do, we take this subject, we put, let's say, on the treadmill, we measure what their VO2 max, so how much oxygen they can deliver to their working muscle at peak effort, maximum running speed they can tolerate for a few minutes. Then we can measure what the percentage of that they can sustain, let's say, for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. And then we measure how efficient they are in using oxygen to produce speed in running. So those are the three predictors, for example, in marathon performance. And maybe we find that this subject is a huge VO2 max. So that is very much genetically determined. So got a huge engine, just born with a very good engine, can deliver a lot of oxygen to his working muscle because he got strong heart, strong lungs, but is not very efficient in running. So the focus is not going to be so much to push up the VO2 max because he's already good in that specific athlete. Is more to work on improving the running mechanics and making more efficient. And normally what we do, we prescribe a program, and then a few weeks later, we retest to make sure that training is paying back. Because this is another problem in all sport. We all have our system to train sometime because we have been exposed to some good athlete training that way and want to mimic what they do. But not necessarily what works for subject A is what works well for subject B. So a lot of us, and I've been witness this for 40 years, keep hammering ourselves, doing just the wrong thing for us. And so I say, no, I train hard, but they don't get better. Yeah, because you're not training what you really need to train. And so some sports are easier to test in the lab. That's why most of the people we see come from endurance sport, like running, skimo, biking, triathlon, and so on. Sport where the neuromuscular components, so the skills are prevalent, are not so easy, although we can still see them and analyze, for example, their motion. We do motion capture tests, so we can see how they move with respect to the sport they practice. And we can do a musculoskeletal evaluation and try to increase the balance of their muscle, you know, and that at least has the potential value to reduce the risk of injury, like say in a golf player. You know, they come over and got some shoulder issue and stuff like that, or back pain. So I would say every sport is a little different, but the approach is the same. Understand the athlete with respect to the sport and try to find out what is holding back that specific athlete and try to correct that.
And I'm quite jealous that I haven't been able to engage in this type of testing throughout my athletic endeavors. as you mentioned, every athlete is different, every person is different, and you're retesting, and I'm sure there's a different recipe for every individual because everyone's unique. The goal of this testing is to find someone's limits, but I'm curious, how often are you testing those athletes once you find that perfect recipe? Because I'm sure it's always a moving target because people are improving in their fitness, their health, their sport changes, and the approach changes. So with that moving target, how are you finding someone's limits throughout the year, let's call it?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. It's exactly like you say. When you test an athlete, basically you're taking a picture, and that picture is correct with respect of the time, meaning also the training phase in which you test this athlete. If you take more tests through a season, basically it's like looking at the movie. So you see the sequence of those pictures going by, and you can see which parameter changing with respect of the training. So in an ideal world, like when I was working with pro teams, you got, let's say, almost unlimited resources. The athletes are full-time athletes, so you don't have to worry about fitting a certain program in a tight work schedule. So what we do at the beginning of the season, we sit down, we start looking at the season, we plan the season, we identify in the season the different blocks of training. This is base. This is going to be building. This is going to be pre-competition. This is going to be an altitude camp. And this is when we start competing. And so already on the map of the season for these athletes, you say, okay, we need to test these three parameters and maybe your iron level in the blood at this time of the year. Then 12 weeks later, we need to test this other parameter and verify if the one we tested before are progressing. So in an ideal world, that would be the way to do. You take a picture at the beginning, you have a plan, and then based on the plan and the goal that you set as a personal goal for that period of time or that season, you decide when to set the testing. That would be an ideal world. You know, in a day-by-day situation, it's not quite like that. But most of the people we see, they're not full-time athletes. And so you try to take the maximum out of the little time you have. Maybe they come two times a year, you know. Clearly, the more data point you have, the more precise you can be in making better choices for the following season and improve working maybe a different angle of that athlete. But it's exactly like you said, you know, you need to monitor. Training is a very imprecise science. So everybody can write a training program. All the training program look good on paper, but the biology of the athletes is not like working with a machine or with an engine. So the same athlete can respond to the same training program differently in different time of the season because he's more tired, has stress at work, has stress at school. So, you know, the only way to limit the errors and the mistake when you train an athlete is to monitor training. And monitor now can be done almost on a daily basis. And a lot of these athletes use wearables. They use software to analyze their training and monitor the training. So they just send us this data and we can look at the data without having them to come in all the time. And we can adjust their training accordingly. So the science and the technology behind the science in the last 30 years has been really changing. So also the way we monitor training has been changing.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Dr. Max Testa. He is at the Sports Performance Center at Intermountain Park City Hospital talking to us about efficiencies in training and testing. Max, I'm wondering, because you have seen so many athletes throughout the decades, how much has the science of testing really informed what you have come to be able to see when you see a certain body? I mean, can you look at a body and say, wow, I bet they have a really high VO2 max? You know, how surprised have you been at the new science versus the anecdotal look that a sports physician can take?
Yeah, so performance by definition is multifactorial. So it's not just based on one thing. Like, you know, we all talk about the VO2 max. Yeah, VO2 max could be a good predictor in some sport, but maybe it doesn't mean that much in other sport. Plus, some people can improve their VO2 max, where other people cannot. You know, they did study on twins, and only identical twins tend to respond similarly to training. There are so many factors. So any technology that allow us to look inside the body particularly understanding the energy mechanism in this subject in a way that is not invasive, they're very welcome. So when I start practicing, and that was early 80s, clearly the way to investigate athlete in the lab was much more invasive. You know, we had some time to take the blood from a vein. The machine we're using to monitor their oxygen consumption were much more constrictive than the way. Now we have open system machine. We can take a blood sample from the earlobe to measure blood lactate concentration. That is an indicator of a metabolic strain of the athlete. They don't even feel it. You know, they feel someone rubbing their earlobe, and we got a micro amount of blood. So everything is so much better. And the other big advantage that now we can see the data real time. Well, when I start working, you were collecting the data. And then in the second phase, you had to analyze the data. So you didn't have the information at the time you were meeting the athlete. Well, now we have everything real time. So tests are becoming much easier for the subject, much less invasive. Matter of fact, you know, when you come in to go through a stress test, it's like going to the gym and do a workout. Mm-hmm. You just have a couple of devices on your body to measure, you know, your heart rate or to check your EKG, measure your lung function. And we take sometimes blood sample for lactate. It really is like doing a workout. It's nothing more invasive than that.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, you know, you mentioned that sometimes the athlete doesn't even need to come in. Can you measure your own blood lactate at home? Can you do your own little ear prick and put it on a strip or something?
Yeah, no, there are some athletes that do it, especially athletes that do intervals, training as part of their training, want to make sure that they work at the right intensity, not too hard, not too easy. They can do that. They can take sometimes they just take from a fingertip, and they immediately, within 10, 15 seconds, they can read on this little machine, portable machine, their level. Now there is a technology that is, I'm sure is going to come out soon, where you can have measure lactate like you measure glucose with continuing monitoring. So you have a little thing attached to your arm, and your phone can read the level of lactate. I have a few athletes that they've been measuring their lactate at home. And sometimes we take lactate after a standardized effort, let's say rowers. They do like for an effort of 2,000 meters at a certain pace based on their level. And then we take lactate at the end, and we take lactate every 3 minutes for 15 minutes to see what the recovery lactate curve is. And then when I see this result, I say, okay, now you need to work more on this quality, let's say VO2 max, versus we need to do a block of training where we focus on your lactate tolerance. So to prepare your body to work in high level of muscle acidosis. Yeah, all these things are happening, and they're not that complicated.
To not put you on the spot too much and divert a little bit from the details of this, but you've been around cycling for so long, and there's obviously such a long history of doping in cycling. And I'm curious, now that the regulations are so heavily investigated and the testing centers and everyone's so engaged in understanding of what the past was, has the training and the testing for the athlete changed at all, or is it all the same without the performance enhancing?
No, so, you know, it's a complicated topic here because, you know, like any sport, because cycling has been put on the stage more than other sport, but there is more doping prevalent in other sport that unfortunately are not even testing their athletes. So it's hard to say, but I would say that in a sport like cycling, the way we test didn't change. What changed a lot is the way we test for doping, so the so-called anti-doping protocol. So when I started working in cycling, the technology in the 80s was limited. There are a lot of stuff that you couldn't even test. So some athletes say, what they can be tested is not doping. Because, you know, that was the philosophy. And so some of these people were not bad people. Just say, you know what? That thing cannot be tested. Why should I not take it if I know that can help? Because nobody guaranteed me that the other ones are not doing the same. So it was kind of a negative situation in a way. Over the years, the technology of anti-doping clearly improved. Now it's very sophisticated. And the big step happened probably around 10, 15 years ago, maybe even 20 now, where they decided that if you cannot find a substance that can enhance performance, you can probably find some indirect markers of this substance. So they developed the concept of the athlete's biological passport. So let's say we cannot figure out if you're doing blood transfusion, let's say, but we can monitor the parameters in the blood, they change after a blood transfusion. So in professional cycling, most of the athletes get tested between 20 and 30 times every year. And the majority of these tests happen outside the competition. So I had athletes of mine that were traveling for a race, and at the connection airport, a commissar show up and they identify themselves, say, need to follow me. They have a room that they arrange next to the airport in an hotel, take blood and urine sample. And so that really, I would say that is never gonna be possible to consider the doping violation like zero in any sport. But you know, they make so difficult to go through this, I would say pretty severe screening process, really kind of discourage the cheaters to do that because they have a lot to lose and not too much to gain. You know, because you cannot really dope that much anyway. Now they talk about microdosing. So the mark, if you are a clean athlete, you can compete against athletes that do a little bit of doping. You may cannot compete about people that do a lot of doping. So I think that the situation is getting much better. By the way, we test the athlete didn't change much.
I've always heard the microdosing recently about other substances and drugs, but never about performance enhancing drugs. That being said, if you're an athlete in Park City and you're engaged in running, golf, tennis, skiing, what's the protocol if you'd like to come into the facility, and how does it work? Is it individual plans, or is your teams or your sponsors pay for it? And how do you come in to get the service and get tested?
Yeah, we have all the above. So we have contract with teams or with organizations. And so we, like, for example, we've been working with the U.S. Triathlon with this podium for the last few years. So we test the best young triathlete in the country that are potential competitor for the Olympics. This has been going on for the last 3 years. So we got 20 to 30 athletes that come and stay in Park City between May, June till September. And we monitor through those 3 months. They come back to the lab. We do VO2 max, lactate test, bifeeding, running analysis, running economy test. And so we create data on all of these athletes. You know, that 50% are male, 50% are female. And already some of the athletes we saw 3 years ago already competed top level, world level, winning medals internationally. So this is gonna be the future. So we do the same for other organizations. Most of the time are just individual. And most of the time they come for a medical reason. They come for a bad knee, or they want a recommendation on changing running shoes because they have a chronic issue. And then we bring them in for a gait analysis, and then they see someone working out doing a VO2 max lactate test, and they start asking, and then eventually come and they do themselves. Everything that is related to a medical condition in general is covered by insurance. So the beauty to have a performance center within a medical facility is that, you know, we can, I would say, we don't separate the performer from health, because in most of the athletes, a lot of issues related to performance are related to health. Let's say exercise-induced asthma. 20% of endurance athletes have exercise-induced asthma, more or less, but only 5% get diagnosed. So some of these people come and they didn't even know that they had a problem there. And so when it's not related to a medical condition, is out of pocket. So we have different prices for different tests or batteries of tests. And so normally I recommend them to come first to sit down either with me or with my colleague, Dr. Jaworski, and tell us about their goals and their issue, and then we can recommend the best path to go through all this testing.
You know, I really love the Live Well Center at Intermountain Park City Hospital. And I always get confused because you seem to go between the Live Well Center, the Sports Performance Center, and the physical therapy. Can you explain how that all works? And I think you're all interconnected and you're certainly right adjacent to each other, but how does it work?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So it's exactly like you say, we're all interconnected. Let's say Live Well program is more a program for preventive medicine, people that want to come and get a good assessment of their health. So they take our executive physical, that is a comprehensive medical evaluation that includes also some physiological testing. So they have an idea about their health and their fitness. When you want to go more specific to a specific sport into performance, that goes under the umbrella of sport medicine. So myself and Dr. Jaworski are sport medicine and sport performance, but we still operate under the same roof, and there is a lot of interchange of patients. So we have patients that come for a physical or for an executive physical, and then they want to have more specific information about how to get faster on the bike or faster runners. And so they got sent to us for that performance evaluation. Sometimes we see people that come for a gait analysis and, you know, they want to have a general health evaluation because in their 60s, in their 70s, or in their 80s. And so we send through the Live Well for have a general medical screening, you know. And physical therapy is just our partner on a day by day. Within physical therapy, we have some performance physical therapists that tend to work more with athletes, especially in the phase when they go back to return to sport, return to competition. So when the physical therapy has been completed, but they need to close that bridge between being okay to for normal daily activity, but they're still a little bit down from where they need to be to go back and training or competing 100%. And so I think we have a good model, and I think it's a model that a lot of other institutions are jealous of because, you know, but you know, it looks like we find a good balance between all these aspects. But the goal, and that is the purpose of the Intermountain Health in general's message, the idea is to give every individual the possibility to live their healthiest lifestyle and do the activity that they enjoy doing, especially here in Park City.
Absolutely. Dr. Max Testa, sports physician at the Sports Performance Center at Intermountain Park City Hospital. So if I were to come out or to make an appointment, I just call the hospital, ask for the Sports Performance Center, and that's okay.
Well, looking forward to seeing you.
Absolutely. I know every time I talk to you, I say, this is what I need. This is what I need. So maybe you'll really see me this time. Thank you so much for joining us on the Mountain Life.
Thank you very much, you guys. Thank you, everybody.
Much. Welcome back to the Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm David Windsor.
Our next guest, Meg Zucker, was born with one finger on each hand, shortened forearms, and one toe on each misshapen foot. It was caused by a genetic condition called ectrodactyly. She would eventually pass this condition on to her two sons. Meg, along with her husband, raised both boys and their adopted daughter, who has her own invisible differences. In her new book, Born Extraordinary, Zucker shows parents how best to empower their children to confront others' assumptions, grow in confidence, and encourage dialogue rather than silence, fear, and shame around difference. She joins us now. Meg Zucker, welcome to the Mountain Life.
Oh, thank you so much. It's just a pleasure to be here.
It's incredible what you have done with your life and with the lives of your children. And I also think your husband is amazing. And at what point as a young girl did you realize that you were different?
You know, it's interesting. From my experience as a young girl, I mean, most people start to notice differences anyway, sometime between the age of 2 and 3. But I was living abroad. And in fact, when we were living in Iran around that age, it was hard not to notice that I was different because people on the street, whether they were just passersby, homeless people, anything, they would maybe notice us or even approach us, and they would take one look at me, scream and start running away because they were worried if I wasn't contagious, my condition, then at least if they were near me, that in fact their family would be cursed with the same condition. And so in terms of me and my own unique life experience, which I do cover in the book, it was pretty extreme. And when people weren't running for the hills, they were definitely reacting with pity. You know, like that kind of sound, if you can hear it, it's like that tis, 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 you know? And so when you're, you know, when I noticed that I was different, it was very young, but it was in a sort of on steroids experience.
Yeah. And I'm wondering what led you to have confidence to go out and marry and have children and start this dialogue around, you know, being different and it being okay and creating a world in which you do have confidence. And as my mother always said when I was growing up, beauty comes from the inside, not the outside. I'm curious, was it the way your parents approached your difference?
Yeah, so it's a great question because my parents really empowered me to live my life, as I like to say, in my own version of normal, capable of doing anything and everything within my means. You know, with their support, I definitely had the confidence in myself to do and try anything and everything, and quite frankly, on steroids. And I probably was trying to prove everything to both everyone and myself that I could do things. And this is on the physical level, and then we can get to the next element of it. But for example, I decided not only to become a cheerleader, but to become, you know, play trombone in the band. And so can you imagine during halftime, I'd have to run and change into my uniform so I could play trombone on with an adaptive device that allowed me to reach all the positions on the trombone. But to, you know, in terms of confidence, so on the one hand, they raised me to feel confident. On the other hand, I was still swarmed with pity, judgment, how to maneuver it. And actually, you know, you mentioned my husband, it was my greatest fear that I wouldn't be able to marry. I wanted to marry, but I couldn't fathom that there would be someone that would be able to look past my difference and embrace me for me. And quite frankly, when I met John, my husband, I actually told him, I don't think that this is genetic. And he was really realistic. He's like, okay, we're going to Mount Sinai. Let's go to geneticists. Let's figure this out. And he's very practical. And so we went and she said, look, it's called extradactyly. It's an autosomal dominant, you know, genetic condition, which means you have a 50-50 chance. For me, I just figured I'd land on the side of the 50 of not having it, just because it started with me wouldn't end with me. And ultimately, how did I get there? I mean, definitely having children that were, you know, share my condition almost sealed the deal. You know, we all love our children unconditionally. And so any of those sort of insecurities or misgivings or anything that I might have personally had, once I gave birth to my difference, literally, I started to have a reckoning. You know, everybody feels that type of level of love for their child, as did I, of course. And now all of a sudden I'm like, well, I can't feel any shame towards my difference because how could I? This is my son. And then ultimately our next child and all of our children, quite frankly.
So with that being said, how did you cope with the fact that you went through this experience as a young child and you experienced it from individuals that quite literally thought it was a contagious thing that they couldn't be around? And so how did it change your parenting style when you knew that you were going to have to encourage and educate your children about their difference?
It's a great question because to your point, my experience was rooted in people's fear, their reactive fear. I write about this in the book too, that, you know, the opposite of, to me, of love is not hate, it's fear. If the negativity that I experienced and I realized was based in fear, then I knew that I had to combat it with the opposite, that in raising our children, I needed to come from a place of strength and empower them to feel their own strength. One of the chapters is called, you know, building their dignity. And doing that, it was a lot of focus on forecasting what's to come. These are the type of experiences you're going to have. You know, none of us likes to feel blindsided about anything. And so by doing that, I was giving them the type of tools that I didn't have. My parents didn't have the same type of experience, but I did. So I could give them that sort of, and you'll see in the book, I actually put, you know, people in kind of categories, you know, of reactions, both even for parents. In the first chapter is called Embracing the New Normal. And it's really, these are the type of reactions you're going to get. And so we do it for the children too. Here's the type of kids, and this is how they're going to react to you. And by the way, you know, David, it's not always negative. You know, one of the types I tell the kids are, you know, there's definitely the curious cats who are going to ask you questions, and there's the mean ones, and there's the whispers and the stares, but there's also the heroes. And those are the kids that just sort of accept you for you. And at some point you're like, don't you want to ask me about my hands? But you start to realize that they're probably just going home in a private moment with their own parents and asking questions, and that's okay. And they're a gift. So that's really where I try to leverage that, all that experience, and apply it to empower our own children.
I love how you refer to them as heroes. And that was kind of leads into my next question, because I had a college roommate who had an accident that put him in a wheelchair. And we were just talking one evening, and he was probably in the wheelchair for 5 years by the time I had met him. And he said that the hardest part about his difference was the fact that he had to get used to that everyone, especially children, would look at him when he went out in public. And that was something completely new to him. And so as a parent, how do you educate your children about people's differences and ways that they can approach it to be the heroes?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting you're describing your friend, because a lot of the times people will react to me or my children and they'll say, oh my gosh, this must be so hard for you. Or, you know, the experience, to your point, of having all of a sudden this attention, unwarranted attention, or unwelcome maybe attention. And it's different when it happens later, you know. And in fact, in that sense, it's almost like building up a muscle, you know. So if you're born different, you've been building that muscle up for years since you really had that, you know, as Lynn was saying, you know, since the moment I noticed I was different, I had to build my muscle up as people were reacting to me and strengthen myself. When somebody has something that happens along the way, like an accident, then it's a very different place of sort of acceptance, and it's much harder, but it's not impossible to address. It's really working towards that similar place of your roommate was an adult by then, but at the same time, you know, it reminds me of this incredible saying that a dear friend who passed away gave to me as a gift, which was, what you think of me is none of my business, you know. And that is so powerful, and it kind of reminds me and draws, like, the kid version is what you think, I don't care what you think about me. But even from a kid perspective, that Dr. Seuss quote, you know, people that mind don't matter and people that don't matter mind, and all that kind of stuff. Like, in other words, you start to realize, you know, and sort of check in with yourself, like, why am I so consumed with people that don't matter in my life? And if you start to kind of put that into a bucket, it helps you to sort of evolve to the place of, this is now my chapter. You know, speaking of a book, I'm an author, right? So it's almost like you have to let go of your former chapter in the description that you provided. And now you're in your new chapter. And your new chapter, your goal is self-love. Your goal is unconditional self-love of yourself and then ultimately others. And by the way, it's really cool, because once you've achieved it, you know, it's all about the attitude. So when you're feeling comfortable and confident in your own space, that's when people, it's almost like a gift that keeps on giving then, because it becomes magnetic. Not only people respond to that, but I've even watched as it motivates other people to say, well, you know what? I want to be the sort of best version of myself too.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Meg Zucker. She's the author of a new book called Born Extraordinary. She was born with one finger on each hand, shortened forearms, and one toe on each foot. It's a condition, a genetic condition called ectrodactyly. Meg, I love what you say about what you think of me is none of my business. And that is such a tool. My mom, you know, when we grew up, it was those same kinds of things. And it was probably the best parenting that my mother could have given me and the best parenting you're giving your kids now, to just say, you know, there's nothing I can do about what you're going to think, other than just be who you are and be confident. And I wanted to bring the language and the lexicon kind of into the conversation. I don't even know when political correctness, that term came about, and there was this surge of political correctness. Now it feels like there's this backlash. And I hear a lot of people who aren't in these various groups of people who may prefer to be called this, not that. And they're saying, oh, what does it matter? Words don't matter. But words matter very much. And I would love to hear why the word difference is so much better than the word disability to you.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because I want to tweak what you're asking, because it's not that at this point in my life, difference is better, you know, for anybody and everybody. I mean, that most important thing is that I've come to realize that, and by the way, your mom sounds awesome. it sounds like she just raised you incredibly, but look, difference for me is something that I embraced because, and I started trying to figure out why, what is it about the term disability? What was it about it? There's people that literally fly the flag of disability pride and embrace that. So who am I to say anything about, you know, the way they label themselves? And I actually realized, by the way, you know, there'll be traffic. It actually happened one day when I was getting ready to go to work, and there was a traffic report, and they said, oh, your day's going to be ruined. There's a disabled vehicle on the road and you're going to be in traffic for hours, you know, lots of luck getting to that meeting, da, 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 da. And so on the one hand, I've realized that there still is a negative, you know, connotation in the common vernacular relating to the word disabled. That said, I think that people that are flying the flag of disability pride are trying to move past that and have people stop using that word in that context, and they're right to do that. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, I start and I address in the book this entire subject just so that we can almost get it out of the way, because you could have a family where children or the person have the same identical condition, difference or disability, it doesn't matter. And one family is going to say, oh, this is my child who's disabled. And the other with the same thing are going to say, this is my child's difference. And you start to realize that the importance is let to me. You're right. Labels are important, but on the other hand, they're important for the family, and it's important to just decide for your family what feels appropriate and right for you. That's what matters. And then once we get past it, I like to say it's really not about, you know, what we label ourselves, but connecting with people who feel the way we feel. That's what matters the most to me.
I'm curious about ectrodactyly and how many people it affects, and have you been through, and have your sons been through various surgeries to correct anything? Tell us more about it. It's the first I've heard of it. However, I think I've probably seen folks with the genetic condition throughout my life and just not known what it was.
Yeah, it's a great question. If you're gonna ask me how many, I should know the answer. It's rare, let's put it that way. You know, you might see people missing part of their arms, and that's not ectrodactyly. Often that's called amniotic band syndrome. And in fact, that's something that can happen in a woman's uterus. And in fact, it's not genetic. So there's differences that, you know, people can have limb differences. And I have to be clear, Born Extraordinary has 30 other contributing parents with kids with differences and disabilities. This is not just about, you know, empowering kids with, you know, ectrodactyly or other type of limb differences. But to answer your question, In terms of surgeries, you know, I describe actually the fact that my parents, although it wasn't a surgery, when I was very young, they couldn't fathom that I could, without having opposable digits, do anything. They didn't know if I was going to be able to walk right, do anything. And so they took me to a place in Chicago to get a prosthetic. And I intuitively just like hurled it across the room. And I described that in the book. It just wasn't right for me. And prosthetics and adaptive devices can be right for people depending on their needs. But because I personally knew that it wasn't something I needed to have to be independent, it wasn't just anything that I ever explored for myself and our sons.
I love how your nonprofit is Don't Hide It, Flaunt It. And you mentioned in the book how you a lot of times wanted just to shove your hands in your pockets and not address it or not let anybody see your difference. And I'm curious about the moment where you decided to embrace this and say, enough is enough, and this is my superpower. And what are the powers that came along with it? What were the things that you realized that you could do and it brought out in you that no one else was able to do?
Yeah, I'm glad that you asked this question because it's so important. I mean, you know, maybe you can tell I'm super outgoing. And so it's really ironic to have a personality where I feel so much joy inside and feel like I just want to connect with people and be my authentic self. And quite frankly, I was hiding my hands in my pockets because in my head I thought, well, that's the worst part of me. So let them know me first. And then they can find out later that this is the deal. And in fact, my first date with my boyfriend in college, I shoved my hands in my pocket the entire date. And he's like, why don't, and we went to a movie and he was trying to grab my hand and he thought I didn't like him anyway. So, and even I'd like to tell you that when I got married to John, my husband, that I was there yet, but I wasn't. And in fact, the wedding dress that I chose, I had them add sleeves so that my shortened forearms and my hands weren't so pronounced. And so I really wasn't there yet. So in terms of Don't Hide It, Flaunt It, you know, I think I finally got there. Our son Ethan was bullied on the playground in first grade for being different. And the principal had invited me to come speak to the, you know, teachers and guidance counselors and said, you know, how can we support your son who is different, you know, or disabled kids? And I realized that walking away, this was a great new opportunity and platform, but that I really wanted to not only empower kids that looked or felt different and become a someone instead of a something, you know, to their peers. But what about the kids that were being willing to taunt? And so I started creating this programming through Don't Hide It, Flaunt It, to help kids feel empowered and to reach others from an empathetic perspective. And so I guess my answer to you is, how could I possibly do that if I'm hiding? And so it was this sort of reckoning with me in this space. No one wishes a bully on anybody, but quite frankly, because of that experience that happened to Ethan, it sort of triggered this new, almost a significant era in my life.
So as you mentioned that it was on your wedding day that you even altered the dress for that, it showed that through adulthood, it was something you were still dealing with. And so I'm curious, I mean, your boys are so lucky to have someone like you who can and embrace this at a very early age and understand exactly what they're going through. And I'm curious where your boys are at in their journey, and tell us a little bit about their skills. Are they good at sports? Are they good at art? What are their gifts?
So, you know, the situation, because I've had Don't Hide It, Flaunt It for almost 10 years. So Ethan is a junior in college. He's actually in Barcelona living his best life, spring semester abroad. And Charlie's a senior in high school right now. You know, you mentioned, how are they in their journey? So they and our daughter, Savannah, I mean, they have joined me at schools across the country speaking. You know, she has ADHD and she's allergic. I'm just going to start with her for a second, allergic to nuts. And so sometimes we talk about the irony of our most difficult part of our lives. People take one look at our family and think, oh my gosh, it must be so hard for you. But actually the scariest, hardest part is her nut allergy. And we've been in the hospital with exposure. So, you know, it's not really everything is what you think, right? In terms of families, and we shouldn't make assumptions about what people are going through in that sense. In terms of how the boys are doing in sports. So Charlie I cover this in the book because I have this chapter called Let Go and Let Live. And Charlie really wanted to play baseball. And he was really adamant that he could do it. And I couldn't fathom, this is one of the mistake categories that I made, and couldn't fathom how could he play, have a glove, wear a glove with, he has two fingers on each hand. But he wrote an essay for my website and said, if the glove fits, and he just really was self-motivated and played baseball for years. But then he got into, in terms of Charlie, he's on the comedy circuit. He does, he performs nationally. He did it in Kentucky and that last year. And he does humorous interpretation, and he's actually going to be doing comedy, performing and writing in college next year. So he gets in front of tons of people. And Ethan just did a TEDx talk about what it's like to be in his shoes as well. So the both boys are, I'm very, very proud to say, just they're not hiders at all.
And that was Meg Zucker, her book, Born Extraordinary, Empowering Children with Differences and Disabilities. Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City.